Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. You're listening to Sparks. This week, a look at high-power microwaves. And I mean high power. 15 gigawatts enough? An interview with John Tusa of the BBC World Service. All about Ada, Lord Byron's daughter, a computing pioneer. The DTI gets tough on illegal radio mics. A new trackable that could send the mice running for cover. How synchronous detection used in the best shortwave radios works. And a look at how much sleep we really need. Well, I shall pass over this ideal chance for a gratuitous dig at commercial radio and tell you that Sparks is on Radio Fax 3910 and 12255.
DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shelving list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radio Fax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67VG in England.
In Observer magazine, a doctor writes, "But dreaming's sweeter. How much sleep do you really need? Probably less than you think. The received wisdom is that most of us need 8 hours, that dreaming is necessary to one's psychological health, and that sleep itself is essential to the process of physical repair. However, Professor James Horn at Loughborough University, the author of a very accessible textbook called Why We Sleep, has found scant evidence in support of any of these propositions. Much of what we know about sleep is based on studies of total sleep deprivation. When you do this to rats, they lose the ability to regulate bodily temperature and mysteriously die after about 21 days. Their skin and fur suffer from what are probably the effects of neglect, but significantly, none of their internal organs shows any signs of deterioration. If you stop and think about it, there is no reason why their organs should deteriorate. Sleep is not a good time for tissue growth, because it's a period of relative starvation. The period of greatest protein turnover, and hence of maximum organ repair, is just after a meal, when the blood is full of amino acids and other good stuff. It's reasonable to suppose that the brain needs to stop working now and again, as muscles do, in order for its biochemistry to settle down. But maybe there is another equally important reason for the amount of time we spend lying down. We need to stop exercising just as much as we need actual sleep in order to promote growth and limit the wear and tear on our bodies. As Professor Horn points out, lying around doing nothing is a fairly advanced form of behaviour. It restricts one to purely intellectual activity, of which most animals, and many people, are incapable. Maybe one function of sleep is simply to force us to take time out. This idea that sleep may not be entirely necessary, that the brain merely decides to give us a holiday from time to time, is to the Western way of thinking deeply seditious. Indeed, we're so wedded to the idea of working all the hours God gave us that we prefer to think of even sleep as work, albeit psychological work, in which, through dreams, we sort out the conflicts of the day. Despite the attractiveness of this idea, there is no evidence that sleep is essential to our mental well-being. Maybe, as Professor Horn suggests, dreams are just a film which the brain plays to keep itself entertained after your body has reached a state of total relaxation. The notion of the essential nature of sleep is supported by the debilitating effect of sleep deprivation in humans. But, as in animal experiments, we tend to focus on total sleep deprivation. The world record in this respect was set in 1964 by someone called Randy Gardner. The name suggests the main protagonist in Lady Chatterley's Lover. In fact, he was a Californian schoolboy who got a group of friends and doctors to keep him awake for just under 11 days. This caused him various symptoms: nausea, slurred speech, difficulty focusing, disorientation, mood changes, and hallucinations. However, he didn't lose control of his heat regulation, which was the cause of death in rats. So it could be that, in humans, sleep deprivation of any duration does relatively little damage. Quite obviously, sleep loss disturbs the functioning of the higher centers of the brain, but this disturbance is a transient phenomenon. After his 11 days without sleep, Randy Gardner didn't, as you might expect, fall asleep like Rip Van Winkle and wake up 5 days later. He slept for 14 hours the first night and had a few longer than average sleeps in the ensuing week. Similar experiments have confirmed that people deprived of sleep for long periods need to recover only about 30% of it. This catch-up sleep has a relatively high proportion of deep, slow-wave sleep and relatively little light dreaming sleep. It corresponds in this respect to the first part of a normal night's sleep. Professor Horn calls this core sleep. It lasts 6 hours, maybe less, and is, in his opinion, all the sleep we really need. Most of us have an immense capacity for sleep. Forced to stay in bed in a darkened room, we will happily sleep for, on average, a total of 14 hours. But less than half of this is really needed. Experimenters in Loughborough have shown that by reducing our nightly sleeping time by half an hour each week, people can adjust quite happily to sleeping 6 hours or less per night on a regular basis. During the day, people on this regime displayed a rather better mental or physical performance than if they'd overslept. This brings us to the conclusion that sleep behaviour is as malleable as eating and drinking behaviour. Some of it is physiologically necessary, but a variable amount is just what we do out of habit. That you can train yourself to do without the unnecessary optional portion of sleep is, on the face of it, a very attractive proposition. We would all like to think we would get more done if only we could keep our eyes open for longer. However, the follow-up to the Loughborough experiment supports Parkinson's law, namely that the amount of work expands to fit the time available. If you stay awake for longer, you won't spend the time reading the complete works of Proust. You will end up, like me, lying on the sofa watching some dreadful old nonsense on late-night TV, in comparison to which total oblivion is a vastly more satisfactory experience. All About Sleep There by Dr. John Colley.
Oh, well, I wasn't expecting that. You could have substituted radio for television at the end and he'd have done the slag off for me. Anyway, Paul Ewers writes from Brill in Buckinghamshire. I enclose a copy of my magazine, Popular Communications, which has an interesting article. I've got a Sony 2001D and have never fully understood synchronous detection. I think this will be a help to others. Well, Paul certainly has found it useful. So here's Harry Helms writing. The idea of synchronous detection isn't new. It first appeared in Electronics magazine, in theory, back in 1952, in an article by O.G. Villard. It was established that the detector stage of an AM receiver is controlled by the strongest signal present in the receiver's selectivity bandwidth, and that the strongest signal should be the carrier of the AM signal being received. For best results, the carrier should be at least 15 to 20 decibels stronger than the sidebands of the AM signal, or any other signal present in the received bandwidth. If the carrier isn't sufficiently stronger than the sidebands or other signals, then proper demodulation can't take place, and you won't get intelligible audio from the signal. Why would the carrier strength vary? There is a phenomenon known as selective fading, which is caused by the fact that the propagation of a signal can vary within only a kilohertz or two. It's common for the carrier of an AM signal to fade while one or both of the sidebands fade less or not at all. If you've heard an AM signal suddenly fade and become distorted, then you've heard selective fading in action. If you tune shortwave at all, you've run into a lot of selective fading. Villard suggested using a once common receiver accessory known as a Q multiplier to boost the level of the AM signal's carrier relative to the sidebands and other signals. Later shortwave listeners started using a technique called exalted carrier sideband, ECSS, to achieve similar results. This technique involves tuning AM signals using the LSB or USB reception modes of your receiver, and tuning so that the signal from your receiver's BFO is exactly matched zero beat with that of the received AM signal. The receiver's BFO signal is the one that controls the detection. protector, and remains constant regardless of how the original carrier fades. However, none of these approaches is a fully satisfactory solution, because of the drift inherent in any receiver. In a valve receiver, you might be lucky to experience a full second of ECSS reception before you have to retune the receiver for zero beat due to drift. Solid-state receivers are better in this regard, but they will eventually need retuning as well. Tuning for ECSS reception when a signal is weak or heavily fading can be difficult. Today's synchronous tuning circuits were made possible for the introduction of phase-locked loop integrated circuits in the late 1970s. A PLL monitors two frequencies, the carrier frequency and receiver BFO frequency in this case, and tracks when they differ. When used in a synchronous detector circuit, the PLL notes whenever the receiver BFO frequency differs from the carrier frequency. If the receiver BFO frequency drifts away from the carrier frequency, the PLL generates a correcting voltage to steer the beat frequency oscillator back onto the correct frequency. When a PLL tracks the BFO frequency in this way, it is said to be locked onto the carrier frequency. A synchronous detector is simple to use. Just tune in the station you want to hear, switch on the synchronous detector, wait a few seconds for the PLL to lock onto the received carrier, and then sit back and listen. Some receivers also let you tune for either the upper sideband or lower sideband if you wish. The result should be greatly reduced distortion due to fading, as long as some carrier from the original AM signal is present. If the original carrier fades, the synchronous detector has nothing to lock onto and cannot do its job. How effective are synchronous detectors? Well, at the risk of sounding like a real weasel, I have to say it depends. I've used two different receivers with synchronous detectors, and their effectiveness varies. On some signals, I've noticed no difference whatsoever. On other signals, including some weak ones right at the noise level, the synchronous detector has been the difference between readable audio and a signal that is there but not copyable. Well, that's Harry Helms with a brief look at synchronous detection from Popular Communications magazine. Well, talking about phase-locked loops, there's a legend, I don't know whether this is true or not, that they were invented by NASA as part of the American space program. If anyone knows whether that's true or not, let me know. I have another letter. This is from M.L. Merritt in Altrincham in Cheshire. I've recently returned to shortwave listening and was pleased to hear your Sparks programme. It's full of fascinating information and the endless loop technique is ideal for this material. Let's have lots more. And less music. There's enough of that all over the broadcast bands. And too little technical educational information. Well, I think we've been having less music in Sparks over the recent weeks, but the occasional record is pretty much necessary to give me a breather now and then, because it's pretty involved stuff doing this programme. Thanks, Mr. Merritt, for writing in.
Leading player on the world stage, Russell Twisk meets head of the world service, John Tusa. Away from the close attention of the television cameras, John Tusa has acquired a tan, a smooth diplomatic manner and a paunch. He spends 3 months a year patrolling his patch, the world, as boss of the BBC's World Service. When he gave up being the high-profile presenter of Newsnight in 1986 to be a manager, he left an intellectual black hole in the programme, which, due mainly to Jeremy Paxman's sly front-loaded questions, has never been successfully filled. At the Sony Awards at the Grosvenor House, the World Service received a special award, and Tusa's appearance on stage to collect it led to the event's only standing ovation. Presenter Michael Aspel had mercifully put pay to all those dreadful thank you speeches by telling award winners, "Thanks, now get off." Tusa was one of the few permitted to speak. Journalists at the press tables clicked on their pens in anticipation, but all he said was, "This isn't the place to make a political speech." He then made the point that those who criticise the BBC's domestic services must not forget that without them there would be no World Service. The following evening I went to his spacious office in Bush House to find out what he would like to have said. He was in a guardedly statesmanlike mood. The World Service celebrates its 60th birthday later this year, and Teusser, with only 7 months left in his job, wants to use the occasion to push the importance of international broadcasting as part of the BBC's charter renewal case. He will still be at the helm when the BBC finally makes up its mind what to do with those endless, leaked and contradictory task force papers, but will almost certainly be gone by the time David Mellor says what is actually going to happen to the charter and the licence fee. It is no secret that Teusser gave up being a performer to get management experience so that he would be a leading contender for the Director General's job. BBC Chairman Marmaduke Hussey put pay to that dream by denying him the chance to even throw his hat in the ring when John Burt was appointed without competition. Was he still angry? My view is that I should have been asked. After all, when I put in for this World Service job, a lot of senior people thought my candidacy was irrelevant. But the then chairman, Stuart Young, didn't listen to them, and it has worked out reasonably well. On that analysis, I think if anyone thought my candidacy for the Director Generalship was so irrelevant that they didn't need to even talk to me, then perhaps that conclusion was as flawed as the first one would have been if they'd taken that view. The explanation took a bit of following, but did it mean that he would be leaving in a huff? No. Anyway, it would have been an awfully long time to stay huffed on the subject. Mine was always a fixed-term contract. He is very proud of what he has achieved in the World Service during his time. When you get the sort of testimonials there have been for our international broadcasting from Russia and Eastern Europe, from the hostages in the Gulf War, it seems more and more people are moved to talk about the impact the World Service had on their lives. He gets very annoyed with MPs who lay about the BBC's domestic services, but then add, "But we think the World Service is marvellous." Teusser says of them, "Firstly, they're trying to drive a wedge into the BBC. Secondly, I don't like us being cast as goody-goodies in the World Service because it's neither accurate nor consistent. We share all our correspondence with the rest of the BBC, and if they're good for us, then they're good for the whole of the BBC." So diminished domestic services would spell disaster for the World Service too. Yes, if the financial benefit is weakened, then the whole budgetary basis of the World Service goes to hell in a handbucket. Also, as part of a chartered body, we have grounds for being independent from the government in an editorial sense. If we became a freestanding World Service separate from the BBC, however dressed up we were with charter-type guarantees, I don't think anybody would believe that we were really editorially independent. The BBC has to be strong, a key player in the British media and cultural sense, and a large news gatherer with an international role. If you just cut and cut, trim back here and there, I think we run the risk of fatally damaging the overall profile. A snip here and there, and suddenly, before you know what is happening, it has fallen apart. I am anxious that the governmental debate doesn't take place on flawed assumptions. Had he suffered from over-interference by the Foreign Office? I haven't made as much progress as I wished. We would be more effective if we had a more flexible relationship. There are all sorts of things we could do with fewer restrictions, more hours, more programmes, just delivering more bang for the buck. We are still limited by a lot of conventions that have been around for a long time. Many people believe, including myself, that the World Service should have its budgets doubled or quadrupled. Far better to scale down the embassies and beef up a service that provides such tremendous value for Britain. Looking back on his past 6 years at Bush House, Teusser says, "Paradoxically, people still think of me as a journalist. But in the last 6 years, I've discovered I am good at running things. I've learned on the job, at this table, with the help of two or three patient colleagues. My key lesson was that you must work out at the start exactly what you want to do. If you don't do that, then the whole thing is useless. Afterwards, you can ask what other people want to do and identify those who want to go along with you or you with them. Only then you can get change. The World Service has never had a higher profile in peacetime. Tusa's ambitious plans for a world news television service are beginning to bear fruit, though constrained by lack of money. His commitment to the future of the BBC is total. Russell Twisk there, interviewing head of World Service, John Tusa.
And the World Service got a mention on BBC One Question Time last week. The panellists were talking about the future of the BBC, and a couple of them mentioned how much better the BBC World Service was than the American ones, you know, the ones, the American things. And Peter Sissons came in, oh yes, you mean CNN, of course, don't you? Oops, you can tell he's never worked in radio. Something rather interesting pop up on 3930 the other Saturday night. It was Radio Bangkok in Thailand. They weren't making any mention of the political situation over there, rather strained as it is with the military shooting innocent demonstrators. Instead, they were playing Lisa Stansfield, as one does. They were playing Brit Awards music, surprisingly enough. This is a thing that seems to be on 95.5, they were announcing it as, and incidentally on 3930. And the presenter was an American female who sounded rather like Jessie Brandon. I wonder. And getting bored with Lisa Stansfield on Radio Bangkok, I tuned down to listen to Paul's show on Radio Facts. And of course, yes, there was Lisa Stansfield. Anyway, some more radio news. Classic FM starts shaping the team for the launch in the autumn. Classic FM has announced the appointment of its programme controller and its sponsorship director as it gears up for its launch in September. The embryonic station has hired Michael Bucht, the founding programme controller of Capital Radio, to schedule the station's output. Michael Bucht is probably better known to you as the chubby presenter of BBC Two's Food and Drink. Now, he says, in an implicit sideswipe at BBC Radio 3, the key objective is accessibility. Classic FM will give easy access to classical music radio for the first time in this country. Despite the drive to create a popular format, Bucht stressed that the station, scheduled to launch this autumn, would aim to serve the highbrow as well as the middle brow of classical music. Well, we heard that with Jazz FM, etc. Let's see if he sticks to his word. Bucht will mastermind the station's 24-hour mix of classical music spanning five centuries, musical and personality features, plus news, travel, weather, and sport for some unknown reason. The station is also using the broadcaster Robin Ray to direct its music policy. Another appointment is Tracy Long, who will generate sponsorship revenue. This will provide a high percentage of Classic's income in single deals for traffic and more weather bulletins, as well as long-term corporate packages. That from Broadcast and Campaign magazine. And back onto the subject of shortwave. On 6210, you can't have helped noticing, Radio Croatia, that's what it is, has popped up, completely wiping out our 6205 transmitter before it blew up. And 6210 incidentally carries news in English if you want to hear the Croatians' view of things. That's from 10 until 10:15 in the evening. And we're working hard trying to get our 6205 transmitter going again. And if you can help us with the donation of some 813 valves, or if you can point us in the direction of anybody who's got any lying in their attic, etc., then we'd be very appreciative. We're not worried about the state of them, just get them to us in one piece. And we'll check them out and we'll refund your postage and be very grateful. That's 813 valves we're looking for. Futurist offer forecasts. Every year the World Future Society publishes forecasts for the years ahead. Some of these forecasts involve technology-related subjects. This is from Microwave Journal, and I thought you'd be interested to hear some of these. A state-of-the-art weather radar system could warn of a tornado forming miles above the Earth as much as 20 minutes before it reaches the ground. Video cameras the size of postage stamps, utilising image sensors with other camera electronics on a single silicon chip. They're predicting they're manufactured for less than $50. Artificial intelligence promises a new industrial revolution by the turn of the century. Artificial intelligence will affect 60 to 90% of the jobs in large organisations by the year 2000, they reckon, and will augment, displace, downgrade, and even eliminate workers. This is an interesting one. Scientists will use sound increasingly to represent and analyse the immense amounts of data generated by supercomputer simulations. Sound provides an additional pathway into the brain for information and reinforces or augments visual data. And predictably, they talk about increased use of robots, computer-aided design and flexible manufacturing. That's something from Microwave Journal. Here's a story in Electronic Design, an American magazine. Interactive trackball relies on force feedback sensing. The ubiquitous mouse and similar computer input devices haven't become artifacts in a museum quite yet, but that's where some may wind up if a new interactive man-machine interface reaches maturity and becomes a commercial product. Under development at the Institute for Perception Research in Eindhoven in the Netherlands, the new device is a trackball that works with tactile feedback. Turning the ball with the finger or thumb, the user moves the cursor across the screen. If the cursor moves in an inappropriate direction, the ball and hence the user senses a resistive force. On the other hand, there's no such sensation or even a stimulating force if the cursor moves in the proper direction, which depends on the application. Today's input devices, such as the mouse, touch screen or the conventional trackball, are good but far from ideal. With the mouse, the cursor is made to shift across the screen by moving the whole device. The drawback is that the user must move the hand and the lower arm. What's more, the mouse and the arm movements take up a lot of desk space. In terms of eye-hand coordination, the directness of data input for the touch screen is unsurpassed, but the user must lift the arm, and that obscures part of the screen. Also, in the long run, lifting the arm becomes tiresome. As for the conventional trackball, it remains stationary, and the cursor can be controlled from an easy chair. The ball just needs to be moved with the fingers and the cursor will move with it, but there's no simple relationship between the ball's movement and that of the cursor, because the straight cursor movements must be related to curved finger tracks across the ball. The cursor will easily shoot off in the wrong direction. That's not the case with this new tactile feedback trackball. The user, on sensing the feedback force, will be guided to move the ball in another proper direction. Combining user comfort with directness of manipulation, This new device also diminishes the visual load or eye strain, because the user goes mostly by what he or she feels. The Dutch device makes for more user comfort, principally because unnecessary cursor detours are avoided. Therefore, reaction is quicker to what's seen on the screen. Perception experts have found that regular eye-hand reaction time is an average of 175 milliseconds. With the force feedback trackball, it's about 30% less. Just when the resistive force is generated depends on the application and on the screen display. For example, a trackable may be programmed so that the cursor easily moves within preferred, say, white areas on the screen, but triggers the force feedback whenever a user tries to move the cursor across darker or non-preferred areas. The team of researchers at the Institute is a joint venture of the Philips Research Laboratories and the Eindhoven University of Technology, and they've implemented the force feedback principle in a demonstration system. The trackball with feedback should be particularly useful for users working with input devices for long periods of time, such as air traffic controllers. The device should also prove its worth in applications where speed and accuracy of operation is important, such as looking at medical computer images during surgery. Having a feedback trackball would also be handy where the user must perform two tasks at the same time. For instance, car drivers who wish to operate the radio in the dashboard while keeping their eyes on the road. With a trackball at, say, the centre of the steering wheel, the driver could control the ball and thus manipulate the car radio's tuning system by sensing the resistive forces on the ball. At the same time, the driver could be keeping an eye on surrounding traffic. That looks like a product waiting for application, and not the first time I've heard that tracker balls will replace mice, but it sounds like an interesting thing waiting to go into production. And that's John Goschk writing in Electronics Design. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, 3910 and 12255 at the moment, and this is Francis Borg, who lives in Priorslee in Telford, Shropshire. I enclose a copy letter to the World Radio Network, which is self-explanatory. I'll read that in a minute. I listen to your Sparks programme quite often, and I find it very informative. However, the reception I get on 6205 on my Matsui clone of the Sangian 803 is not very good. Hence my suggestion that your programme material, which is first class, can be enjoyed without any fading. I presume you've heard of their test transmissions on the Astra satellite, and I think it's great. When I talked to them over the phone, they asked for your address, which I duly gave them, and apparently I'm not the only one with the same opinion that you should go on satellite. I hope you will be able to arrange a trial at least, and I'm sure your listeners will all agree with the move. So this is what he says to World Radio Network. I hope your network will be a complete success because the service is pretty well unique and the quality superb. It might take some of the fun out of shortwave radio, but it certainly makes up for that in listening capability. I'm pleased to see that you have omitted to broadcast the shortwave stations that are already on Astra, like Radio Sweden, SRI and DW. You might consider, however, getting a good home to a good shortwave pirate station, Radio Fax, which provides a lot of good technical information. After all, a famous pop pirate station has recently found a home on Astra with QEFM, Quality Europe FM. I hope you'll include some stations which broadcast a DX programme. Hopefully that includes satellite communications as well. My congratulations and best of luck for an interesting future. Well, what's all this, you may ask? Well, this is a thing that went on for about a week, an experiment of various shortwave stations being relayed on satellite throughout the day. And you can write to the World Radio Network at 70 Florence Road, Wimbledon, London, Southwest 19, 8TJ. Well, frankly, it's all a matter of money for us, really. And I think, personally, I agree with what Ronan O'Reilly has said on the subject of satellite radio, which I won't repeat. Basically, shortwave radios are expensive enough, decent ones, and satellite equipment, well, I've got no intention of buying one. I'm quite happy with the television I've got. Well, when you consider the number of radio stations you can get on an ordinary tranny you can buy for 50p, then is it worth several hundred pounds to get a handful more? And the actual quality of the programmes on these things compared with terrestrial radio stations is somewhat dubious as well. But You can tell that I'm not really an impartial person in this matter, so we'll leave it to what you think. Write in and tell us. The address, as ever, is Sparks Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And I'll take any comments you write in on board and read your letter out, bits of it out on air, and say hello to you. And if you'd like a reply, please enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. So the magic address, Sparks Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And from Birkenhead now is James Robinson. You may remember I wrote to the programme a few weeks ago congratulating you on your Sparks programme. Just before you read my letter out, you mentioned an address where I could obtain a copy of a book about German number stations. I'd be grateful if you could repeat the details for me, as I was unable to take the information down. I've often wondered about these stations. Around 2 weeks ago, I picked up one on 6200, which had a sequence of 10 minutes at a pulse tone, 10 minutes of numbers interspersed with a musical box, followed by 10 minutes of numbers again. The music box sequence started on the hour and half hour. Incidentally, your programme on the 27th and 28th of April said that Sunshine Radio in Ludlow would open in 6 weeks. On hearing this, I phoned them and told them you'd said this. However, it is not expected to start until September. Finally, good luck getting a licence. Keep up the battle. From James Robinson. So here are the details on the book about number stations, Secret Signals, the Euro Number Mystery. That's published by TR Publications USA, spelt T-I-A-R-E. Or you can get one for £6, including postage and packing, from the author Simon Mason, 26 Bloomfield Avenue, Hull, HU5-5NH, in England. That's for a copy of Secret Signals, the Euro Number Mystery. £6, including P&P, from Simon Mason, 26 Bloomfield Avenue, Hull, HU5-5NH, in England. And incidentally, number stations fans, we've also heard them around our frequencies on 3910 and 12250. That's the last one in German and is on Wednesday evenings at around 10:30 British time.
For the pain was more John Wayne than anything else that there is.
In an article entitled Computer Fairy, Penelope Fitzgerald reviews the book Ada, the Enchantress of Numbers, a selection from the letters of Lord Byron's daughter and her description of the first computer. In 1823, Charles Babbage received cautious backing from the government for his automatic calculator, the Difference Engine. His heart, however, was in his analytic engine, the first version of the modern digital computer, which was to be programmed by punch cards, something like a Jacquard loom, and driven by steam. The analytic engine was not backed by the government and was never completed, but a description of it was published in 1843 with a series of notes addressed to the Victorian reading public, explaining its possibilities and giving instructions for use. There is no finite line of demarcation which limits the powers of the analytic engine. These powers are coextensive with the knowledge of the laws of analysis itself. The notes were by Ada, Countess Lovelace, Byron's daughter. Her mother was Annabella Milbank, the overpowering and very wealthy mathematical Medea. Ada only knew her father as a legend. Mama did not tell her until she was 26 the unpleasant story of the divorce. By then, Ada herself was deeply plunged into a restless marriage, with three unruly children and a confusion of tutors, physicians, gambling debts, and constant hospitality. Babbage, hospitable enough himself, was a tireless visitor. Ada, conscious of some portion of natural genius, but not quite sure whether to express herself in music or philosophy, turned to him to find an instructor in mathematics. 4 years later, she started work on the notes. In 1974, the United States Department of Defense sponsored a competition to develop a new high-level computer language to replace Fortran. The winning design was given the name Ada. This was the starting point for Betty Toole, an education consultant who has edited this selection of letters from Ada Lovelace, with an introduction and commentary. As an historian, she doesn't aim high. The 19th century started with a bang. England was involved in the Napoleonic Wars. But as a biographer, she is patient and protective. She defends Ada against the charge that, as a woman, she was no more than Babbage's amanuensis, and that the notes were not really her own work. Lastly, she defends the Ada software language. Overextended in the 80s, she says, it has been undervalued since. Though usually short of money, Ada did much as she wanted, and was always a patron rather than patronized. Her great achievement was not so much that she was the first computer programmer, but that she believed, when so few others did, in the analytic engine's future. She died at the age of 36, having been treated, as far as I can make out, on the Brownian system of alternate doses of alcohol and laudanum. She asked to be buried at Newstead Abbey, next to Byron. Lady Byron, who had objected strongly to Ada's mythic image of her father, did not come to the funeral. That review of a book called Ada, the Enchantress of Numbers, all about Lord Byron's daughter and her involvement with Babbage and the invention of the computer, is published by Strawberry Press, Mill Valley, California, at £17.99.
Electronics Weekly reports that high-capacity computer storage and compact discs that store more music and even full-length feature films will result from research into blue light lasers at two Japanese companies. Four times more data can be optically stored using blue light lasers, since blue light is half the wavelength of red light, the shortest wavelength emitted by current laser chips. Blue light chips could be developed by Nissin Electric using molecular beam epitaxy techniques to make semiconductor crystals of sufficiently high quality. Sanyo is working on a different approach, which involves frequency doubling or second harmonic generation to generate blue laser light. This technique involves pumping infrared laser light through a dielectric material. Sanyo is working on ways of shrinking the technology. Well, we'll bring you more news on that as and when we hear it. And tell you about Northampton Radio Club's Radio Electronics and Computer Car Boot Sale now. This is on Sunday the 7th of June, and it starts at 9:30. Now to get there, you want to come off the M1 at Junction 16, take the A45 East 400 yards, and you'll get to the Red Lion, and it's behind that. A licensed bar, hot food, car parking and bring and buy is what they announce, and it's 50p a car parking. Now to get a stand, it's £6.50 in advance or £9 on the day. And bookings or inquiries are to Mr. P. Young, 21 Brockhall Road, Floor, Northampton, NN7 4NG. And his telephone number is 0372 41267. That's 0372 41267 for the Northampton Radio Club's car boot sale, which is just off Junction 16 of the M1 and then 400 yards east along the A45. At the rear of the Red Lion. Now, shock horror, something through from Apogee by the HHB Broadcast Distribution Company. Just when you thought that compression, limiting, etc. was dead in the days of compact disc, all that stuff was gone with LPs, etc. Well, we bring you Apogee's AD500 Stereo Analog Digital Converter, which has already become the United States industry standard front end for use with digital audio tape, disc-based recorders, and CD mastering. And wait for it, its unique soft limiting feature imperceptibly controls transients, permitting several dB more average level to be put on CD or DAT, while soft saturate actually simulates the sound of analog tape compression. Heaven forbid, don't tell any hi-fi purists, will you? That's Apogee. It's a very flashy thing in a purple box with purple knobs and a grey front panel, and I shall throw that straight in the bin. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, and here's something from the Evening Standard. The BBC will destroy Britain's commercial radio stations if it sells off Radio 1 and 2, a secret internal report has warned. There would not even be enough advertising revenue to keep Radio 1 and Radio 2 alive, the BBC document claims, predicting financial difficulties for the planned network national commercial stations, including Richard Branson's pop station and Classic FM. The report says independent local radio would be reduced to an income similar to that of 1987 in total, in real terms, but with four times as many stations operating. Revenue would have to shoot up to £340 million at 1991 prices by the year 2000. That's £121 million higher than expected on industry trends, if commercial radio and Radio 1 and 2 were to survive. That's according to a secret internal report, one of many that have been leaked before this big BBC conference in the country out at Luckham Park, which has had lots of coverage, so I won't go into it anymore, apart from to let you in on the fact that the BBC has called in spitting image creator John Lloyd to help shape the corporation's survival plan into the next century. Mr. Lloyd, age 42, is the only outsider, apart from Minister of Fun David Mellor, to be involved at the BBC's top-level summit at Luckham Park. Sorry, I mean National Heritage Minister David Mellor. This week on Sparks, a look at high-power microwaves. And I mean 15 gigawatts, that high enough for you? An interview with John Tusa of the BBC World Service, all about Ada, Lord Byron's daughter, a computing pioneer, the DTI get tough on illegal radio mics, a new tracker ball that could send the mice running for cover, how synchronous detection used in the best shortwave radios works, and a look at how much sleep we really need. Sparks every Monday and Tuesday on Radio Facts.
Get breakfast as well. That's the why I am. Heaven help me. He said we don't like peace campaigners round here. Is he nailed another one to the wall? that's what gets me in trouble, heaven help me. Goodbye and good luck to all the rubbish that you've spoken. Goodbye and good luck to the promises you've broken. Your life has lost its dignity, its beauty and its passion. Nights you're gonna get caught, it will give you a pregnant pause for thought. You're a dedicated swallower of fascism. Time up and time out for all the liberties you've taken. Time up and time out for all the friends that you've forsaken. And if you choose to waste away like death is back in fashion, you're an accident waiting to happen. Clothing of a wolf in sheep's clothing in this carnival of carnivores, heaven help me. Goodbye and good luck to all the rubbish that you've spoken. Goodbye and good luck for all the promises you've broken. Your life has lost its dignity, its beauty and its passion. You're an accident.
Channel 69 and the DTI. Some years ago, a concerted government campaign to put an end to the pirate radio industry came unstuck. The principal frustration that the Department of Trade and Industry faced in their efforts was that the stations and the criminals operating them were afforded an economic and moral legitimacy by serving public demand for incremental stations, playing music largely ignored by legal radio stations. Faced with the public sanctioning of illegal activity, the government was forced to temper their enforcement measures with a deregulation of the airwaves to allow broadcast licenses to be awarded to a host of new stations, including some of the former pirate radio stations. Parallels with radio microphone technology may not be immediately obvious, but both concerns are covered by the same 1949 Act, and large numbers of people are out there using illegal radio equipment that could, in theory at least, land them up with 2 years imprisonment and or an unlimited fine, as well as forfeiture of the offending hardware. The restrictive nature of legislation has meant that, knowingly or otherwise, many have simply flouted the law in order to make use of radio equipment readily available to them. The fact was that even in the 1980s, the DTI had little idea as to the actual level of RF usage in the independent sector, simply because it was largely unlicensed. At one time, a figure of some 2,000 radio microphone users throughout the entire country was quoted by the DTI. More recently, however, things have been changing. Through their appointed agents in the field, ASP Frequency Management Limited, the DTI has been working more closely with manufacturers to bring some semblance of reason to the relationship between regulator and regulated. To begin with, the major manufacturers have sought to ensure that their equipment fully meets DTI licensing requirements, while the DTI has accepted operational suggestions from the manufacturers that will allow greater ease of operation on the new Channel 69 UHF waveband recently introduced to replace the old Channel 35. In addition, the DTI has bowed to pressure from these manufacturers to ensure that the legal requirements they have sought to observe are now observed by everyone else. At the moment, if you're in a band using radio mics, you are more than likely to be illegal, states John Willett, technical manager of Sennheiser UK. There is a lot of equipment about, either on non-legal frequencies or on a legal channel, but with the transmitter not having passed DTI type approval. No doubt a large number of the people using the deregulated channels will be somewhat surprised to discover that they are operating illegal equipment, having purchased it in good faith from their dealer. But, like it or not, the onus is firmly on the user. The dealer is currently under no obligation to inform the customer of the legal position when selling the equipment, though there are some moves afoot to have the law changed in this respect. There is still plenty of equipment being sold in this country that is not approved for operation in the UK. A lot of retailers do take the attitude that it's all right if people want to buy the stuff, admits Fraser Murray from the DTI's Radio Investigation Service. We are certainly aware that there is a lot of unapproved gear out there, which is unfair on manufacturers who have sought approval. And while not wishing to give details of any campaigns that may be about to be launched, radio microphones represent a problem area that has come to our attention. Confirming that it is within the powers of the courts to treat transgressors as though they were broadcasting a pirate radio station, Murray is keen to draw a more appropriate parallel with a campaign the DTI ran last year in respect of radio car alarms. A lot of the systems that retailers were selling to the public were unapproved and illegal, and we adopted an information and education policy towards solving the problem. If we could achieve the same result with that kind of campaign with radio microphones, then we would do so. Murray, however, does concede that there are a couple of cases being considered for prosecution following the car radio alarm campaign. The use of VHF equipment can be technically problematic these days due to the proliferation of computer-based control systems and digital processing equipment on stage. UHF is less prone to external interference. A lot of computer and digital equipment throws out so much radio trash, it's horrendous. Bands have been having problems with VHF radio mics where they've got all this digital signal equipment. It's throwing out harmonics that interfere with the radio mics. On January the 2nd, 1992, the new Channel 69 waveband became operational across the UK, an act that should go a long way to alleviating many of the problems currently faced by fixed site users. According to Brian Copsey of ASP Frequency Management, discussions with the DTI continued for more than a year about a replacement for Channel 35. It became increasingly obvious that Channel 69 was going to be the only available spectrum to replace Channel 35. It's always been known that Channel 35 would be a temporary band. Now that it has been given over to the new Channel 5 television station, it will become unusable when they begin test transmissions in January 1993, though there has been talk that they may postpone it until April or July. Transmission will cover the whole country, although there is the possibility of holes in the London and Birmingham areas where Channel 35 radio equipment will still be operable, because Channel 5 TV is transmitting on Channel 37 rather than Channel 35. Crystal Palace will be transmitting on Channel 37, but Oxford will be on Channel 35, for example. So it is a question of whether or not that Oxford signal gets across the Chiltern Hills as to whether Channel 35 operation for radio mics will still be possible in London. Birmingham looks quite tight as well. Bristol, Cardiff and along the south coast, Bournemouth and Brighton, look like they might also remain free to Channel 35 users. But in reality, I think it will be quite impractical and Channel 35 will just die out. Mobile licences will no longer be available for Channel 35, but ASP will continue to issue fixed site licences, claiming that most of the London theatres will be able to continue to use these frequencies. To check the validity of this claim, we will just have to wait until Channel 5 starts broadcasting. Within the new Channel 69, there is a 25 kHz frequency grid within which manufacturers can choose where they operate their radio microphones. Brian Copsey from ASP describes persuading certain parties at the DTI to agree to this kind of operation as a tough negotiation and states that there was considerable initial opposition to the proposal. In trying to achieve the most efficient and flexible use of the spectrum, we are very concerned to see this stand up as bulletproof and as a blueprint for the future. That article, describing the possible end to more than 20 years of inadequate allocations for stage use of radio microphones, published in Audio Media magazine.
Columbia now 9 times the speed of sound.
Little love with just my
Japan plans to develop an unmanned aerial vehicle, a UAV, powered by solar energy or microwaves transmitted from Earth. The UAV will be used as a telecommunications relay and as a remotely controlled platform to serve as a monitor of emergencies such as floods, earthquakes, and other natural disasters. Japan's National Aerospace Laboratory has recently completed work on the first cut concept definition of the robotic device. NAL's concept includes two methods of powering the UAV, a piston engine for takeoff and an electronic motor for cruise. The next phase of the program involves fabrication of a scale model to be used to test airframe feasibility. Similar programs using microwaves to power UAVs have been investigated in the United States and Canada. However, progress has been limited due to inadequate funding. That's a little report in Microwave Journal. And in the same magazine, an introduction to high-power microwaves. James Benford and John Swingle. The area of high-power microwaves has emerged in recent years as a new technology, allowing new applications and offering innovative approaches to existing applications. The great leap in microwave power levels has been driven by a mix of sources that push up conventional microwave device physics into new directions, or imply altogether new mechanisms, running counter to the trend in conventional microwave electronics towards miniaturization, with solid state devices intrinsically limited in their peak power capability. High-power microwave generation taps the immense power and energy reservoirs of modern, intense relativistic electron beam technology. The term high-power microwaves is used to denote devices that exceed 100 megawatts in peak power and span the centimeter and millimeter wave range of frequencies. The definition is arbitrary, but does cleanly divide the conventional microwave devices from a collection of microwave-generating devices that have now reached powers as high as 15 gigawatts. Microwaves were the first part of the electromagnetic spectrum to be generated artificially by Hertz in the 1880s. Radio came into use at lower frequencies in the early 20th century, with the invention of gridded valves. In the 1930s, several investigators realized that higher frequencies could be obtained by using resonant cavities connected to electrical circuits. The first cavity device, the Klystron, was produced in 1937. This was followed by a burst of activity during the Second World War that included the extrapolation of the magnetron, best known today as powering microwave ovens, and the invention of the traveling wave tube. That's the thing that provides the signals for direct broadcast by satellite, and the backward wave oscillator. I don't know what that's used for. These sources were all powered by modulators that use gridded power tubes, or valves, depending on which side of the Atlantic you come from. In the 1960s, the cross-field amplifier was developed. The 1970s saw the strong emergence of solid-state-based microwave sources. By this time, microwave tube technology was oriented towards volume production, and the research effort was curtailed. In the 1950s, Project Sherwood marked the first effort to control thermonuclear fusion for energy production. The experimental and theoretical studies begun in conjunction with this effort led to a detailed understanding of the interaction between particles and waves. In the 1960s, electrical technology was extended with the introduction of pulsed power, leading to the production of charged particle beams with currents of greater than 10 kiloamps at voltages of 1 megavolts and more. These intense beams were applied to the simulation of nuclear weapons effects, inertial confinement fusion, and other studies of high-energy density physics. The availability of intense relativistic electron beams was the last piece in the puzzle, allowing the knowledge of wave-particle interaction gained in the study of plasma physics to be put to use in the generation of microwaves. As a consequence of this, the culture of the high-power microwave community lies closer to those of plasma physics and pulsed power communities than to that of conventional microwave tube builders. The use of high voltages to produce relativistic electron beams with electron energies comparable to the 510 kiloelectron volt rest energy of an electron has had several profound consequences for high-power microwaves. One is the introduction of devices based explicitly on the relativistic effects, such as the gyrotron. In the future, it is anticipated that the two fields of high-power microwaves and conventional microwave devices, which have constituted different communities, technologies, and traditions, will converge in the future. Merging these technologies and communities will be of great advantage to both. Conventional devices can frequently benefit from higher power, and certainly from the techniques of high power that are being developed for high-power microwaves. More importantly, they can benefit from many aspects of conventional technology. Perhaps the most important of these is clean environments, most especially improved vacuum techniques. Another area of importance is the control of breakdown. A third area is regulation of pulsed electricity due to driving the sources. The emergence of a variety of commercial high-power microwave sources may be seen in the next decade. Already some types, including magnetrons, vercators, klystrons, and gyrotrons, are available commercially, and it is expected that many other source types with improved parameters will become available as applications and as the market for those sources emerges. Ultimately, the ability of high-power microwaves to achieve maturity will depend upon its ability to serve applications with a true market. These markets are only beginning to emerge and could include particle acceleration, industrial processes and environmental cleanup, modification of the ionosphere, power beaming, or one of many defence applications. That's James Benford and John Sweigle. Just a small part of their article on high-power microwaves. And if you think that was complicated, you should see the rest of it. And that's from Microwave Journal. Incidentally, talking about magnetrons, as I said, commonly used in microwave ovens, I've seen a fascinating article in CQTV, which is the Journal of the Amateur Television Mob, all about how to turn your microwave oven into a high-power microwave transmitter. Although I wouldn't try it while you're cooking the dinner.
I was on the porch, jigging downstairs in the basement, passing.
listening to Sparks on Radio Fax, presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. And this hasn't got an awful lot to do with science and technology, but I thought you'd be amused to hear this. This is in our old friend The Observer by John Sweeney. Sandy Baldwin got a good offer for her house on Friday, but yesterday she woke up to find high-tech hippies had invaded her peaceful Malvern Hills. Dervishes whirling to ear-splitting rave music, dogs running semi-wild, aging lorries being revved hard, and motorbikes without silencers ridden by gaunt figures in top hats. The invasion looked chaotic, but it was well organised. The old hippie mantra of peace, goodwill and disorganisation has been put aside by the techno-travellers, who outwit police and locals by skilled reconnaissance and use of the ultimate in Thatcher accessories, the Vodafone. Far out, man, has given way to my batteries are running low, man. Last week, the bank holiday rave on Castle Morton Common, Gloucestershire, was throbbing with the sound, to the evident distress of the locals. One farmer said, "I'm gonna shoot the blokes," but contented himself with seeing off a stray dog which had wandered onto his chicken farm with a well-aimed throw of a stone. Pensioner Mary Weaver was comparatively calm. She had discovered the invasion at 6:30 a.m. when she looked out of her bedroom window. "Oh," I thought, "I'd better put my clothes on." Mrs. Baldwin, aged 35, was admirably stoic about how the invasion would affect her plans to move house, and reining in the moral panic that was fizzing across Worcestershire. A lot of them have been quite polite. I'm not knocking them at all, but there's no sanitation, no hygiene, and I had to keep my little ones up late last night until eventually they fell asleep from exhaustion. A stone's throw from her bluebells, granny caps and lilies of the valley stood a circle of hippie wagons, part of about 1,000 vehicles bringing some 5,000 people to the beauty spot. At the centre of the circle was a sound system decorated with concentric circles, blasting out whistles, shrieks and bass notes that make up this summer's new music. Everybody knew about the invasion, including the local West Country Samaritans who have a tent at the festival, except the police. Even Mrs. Weaver had seen the techno-hippies reconnoitre the common a month ago, but everything seems to have taken the police by surprise. The Avon Free Festival, to give the event its rather grand title, is composed of a mixture of young people. The most arresting visually are the hardcore travellers, known to the ravers or house music enthusiasts as soap dodgers, a nickname not without an element of truth. The men, women and children are often tattooed, ring-nosed and brown-skinned. Their dogs and children run amok as free as nature intended. Two sheep have already been savaged, according to local councillor Alex Stewart Cleary. Among the travellers, there is a subset of crusties who are into self-mutilation. They drink cans of strong lager and cider, sneer at people who look normal, and jig to the music. It will be wrong to overdo the psychotic terror. Catching as it is, many of the travellers are beautifully spoken dreamers. One such is Steph. He wouldn't give his proper name, who parried a question about the high-tech travellers by declaring, "There's no organisation. This is anarchy working as it should. The site is self-policing. It's an ecosystem. Of course, a few people will fight, but it's only personal stuff." His accent was flawless Queen's English. Where did he go to school? "I did geology at university." And his school? "I worked on the North Sea." And his school? Finally, he conceded he had gone to Ampleforth College, the top Roman Catholic public school. The travellers have even less money than the ravers. These are known as the cheesy quavers to the soap dodgers. The ravers have names like Techno Travellers, DIY, Conspiracy, Adrenaline, Circus Warp, Spiral Tribe and Bedlam. They tend to look much more ordinary, but are just as peculiar in their own ways. But the travellers and ravers were somewhat more innocent than the people who prey upon them both, such as earnest Thatcherite entrepreneurs who peddle an alchemist's store of drugs. One Thatcherite broke off his lecture on media ethics to take a call on his Vodafone. "Just come down here and I'll get you sorted out," he said. His cool entrepreneurship seemed at odds with Steph's public school peace-nickery. The festival involves a lot of strands, none of them terribly coherent. Does that remind you of something? It does me. Anyway, George Williams writes to us from Redruth in Cornwall about Pirate FM, which he says is boring already. No country and western, all the same sort of music night and day. Boring chart and BBC Radio and 1 and 2 type jingles. I listen to Radio Facts instead and Sunday Morning Pirates. Well, thanks, George. And he asks if we got his tape of Pirate FM. Well, yes, and I did a little piece on it. Unfortunately, that's in the programme that's lost in the Irish Post at the moment, so sometime it'll resurface.